It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Kate Archer-Kent. How do you put a price tag on a life lost to a drug overdose? And who is responsible for the epidemic of prescription drug abuse in the United States? Those were some of the questions raised by lawsuits against the makers and distributors of highly addictive opioid painkillers. Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, could spend billions of dollars to address the crisis if a settlement deal is approved by a judge in a bankruptcy court this week. But will it mean that everyone in America suffering from an opioid addiction will be able to get treatment? Should company executives be held personally responsible? We're talking about where those lawsuits have ended up and what it means for those who've been harmed. You can join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org. With us is Jan Hoffman, a reporter who writes about behavioral health and health law for the New York Times. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning.
Good morning. So bring us up to speed on these settlements against opioid manufacturers and distributors. There have been so many lawsuits. Where do things stand currently?
Imagine, let's just say two buckets for now. The Purdue bucket is in a separate area. Okay, we'll talk about the other big bucket, which is for the most part sitting in front of a federal judge in Cleveland, Ohio. That bucket holds thousands of lawsuits from little towns, counties, states, tribes, hospitals, and insurers, as well as other plaintiffs. And that bucket faces easily two dozen companies. The companies break down into three categories. You either make the drug, you truck it across the country, or you dispense it to the patient at your pharmacy. So three kinds of companies are being sued. For the most part, that big bucket in Ohio is slowly being emptied, very slowly. Last month, the three big distributors, the companies that distribute the drugs, and Johnson & Johnson, one of the big manufacturers of the drugs, settled for $26 billion. But that deal is not yet complete.
And so all of these cases, you talk about the federal cases before the judge in Ohio. The intent there was to consolidate them, right? Because there were just so many, as you mentioned, governments across the country who are dealing with the fallout of the epidemic, paying for emergency healthcare services, for child protective services, all of the human services related that counties and towns have to pay for in this crisis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They're seeking some relief. But as you mentioned, they're starting to get settled. Now, is it still the intent to come up with one global agreement that addresses all of the concerns of all of the governments across the country?
Hope springs eternal. But basically, the global agreement now really has to do with, one company or a couple of companies at a time with a group of plaintiffs. They're never going to settle. It's just not going to happen to have, say, 24 or more companies sitting down and writing the same agreement with thousands of plaintiffs. So, for example, the three big distributors in Johnson & Johnson, if that settlement really does go through, and it ain't a done deal yet, it's pretty close, but it ain't over, they get a quote-unquote global settlement with their plaintiffs. Similarly, tomorrow, a judge is supposed to come down with the final order on Purdue. And if that goes through, Purdue gets a quote unquote global peace with its thousands of plaintiffs.
And how did we get to the point of settlements? Why are we not going to trial? Why are we not seeing these cases on trial?
Well, Well, I think you need to think a little bit about what's involved in getting to trial. Frankly, most plaintiffs and defendants don't want to go to trial because it takes an incredibly long time. It's expensive. And frankly, in Purdue alone, that's just one company. Lawyers have already burned through hundreds of millions of dollars in legal fees that could have been gone to settlement. Going to trial takes much longer. And frankly, going to trial is always a gamble. You don't always get a jury. You may just do it in front of a judge. The standard of proof is high. The laws are rigorous. And either the plaintiff could lose and lose big, or the defendant could lose and lose big. So it's always a very expensive gamble, and it is much more desirable to settle before you get to trial. Of course, the big deterrent, the big downside for the public interest and what gets lost is we, the public, do not get to hear a full accounting of what truly happened. And that happens in open court.
Yes. So as you mentioned, there's an interest by both parties in reaching a deal on behalf of the companies. The company's looking to bring an end to this, and the government's looking to not spend legal fees that they perhaps don't have on lawsuits that can last and are lasting years.
Years.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about this settlement, so you mentioned $26 billion on the table with Johnson & Johnson. What is that?
That's four companies.
Four companies, 20. Including Johnson & Johnson. Where's that money going to go?
I'll tell you where it's going to go or where it should be going according to the deals. But I can't help repeating, and I know it sounds a little bit like a broken record, that there are a lot of hurdles to get to jump over before the money starts, before anyone writes a check.
Right. We're not even there yet.
Oh, we are so not there yet. Mm-hmm. We are so not there yet. And this at a time where, as you correctly pointed out, during the pandemic, deaths from overdoses to both street and prescription opioids were the highest they've ever been. So we are truly in an emergency situation and checks need to be cut. But that said, according to the settlements that are being written, the money is supposed to go very specifically to funds that allocate for treatment, for prevention, for all kinds of services to what's known as abate the opioid epidemic. And there are guardrails, monitors in place to assure that what happens to this money does not happen to what happened to the big tobacco money, which was basically disappeared into state budgets and used to fix potholes and all sorts of other non-tobacco related problems.
Right. That is on my mind as we're talking about the urgency of addressing this epidemic that has been going on for years, has cost so many lives, and yet we're in this protracted legal battle with all of these companies, maybe approaching the finish line, that we can maybe see a finish line in the horizon.
I hate to say it. I don't want to pour cold water on your hopes. although as a journalist, isn't that my job? But I talked to a number of lawyers who said that they think they're maybe about a third of the way through.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And really, checks are not flowing yet. The hurdles to finalize the deal with the big three distributors in Johnson & Johnson could take a year.
Wow.
And that includes getting buy-in from every single state saying okay, and all the communities in the United States who sued saying okay.
Yeah, a whole lot to talk about there.
Even then, if they agree, the payments for that money come out over 18 years.
Mm. Mm. We are speaking with New York Times reporter Jan Hoffman, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about massive opioid settlements pending across America. What consequences do you think pharmaceutical companies should face for the opioid epidemic? We're discussing this with New York Times reporter Jan Hoffman, and you can join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@wpr.org. So, Jan, we were talking about these settlements that are perhaps years off in the horizon, yet we have this raging epidemic. We have people that need treatment. We have governments that are being affected by the burden of handling this pandemic. And we have these settlements on the horizon. So I want to talk about Purdue Pharma. We mentioned briefly the Johnson & Johnson and other distributors. We have this separate settlement deal with Purdue Pharma that has made its way to bankruptcy court, and we are expecting the ruling on that imminently. What do you expect to see out of that bankruptcy judge's decision?
It should. Well, it was supposed to happen numerous times already, but currently it's scheduled for tomorrow morning, where the bankruptcy judge is expected to approve. This is now the 10th amended version of the bankruptcy plan that will break up Purdue Pharma as we know it, rebuild it into a different company, and extract a fair chunk of change from its now soon to be former owners, the Sackler family.
And so as part of this settlement, they would agree to pay governments over $4 billion over the course of 9 years. And they would not accept any admission of wrongdoing. Is that right?
Yeah. Correct. Correct.
So where does that leave us? As far as who's responsible for this crisis, has that been addressed?
Well, I guess it's a very complicated question, and it's one of the reasons these cases are so difficult to press, because there are so many actors in the tragedy, and this is not saying, for example, that any company shouldn't be held liable. But you need to think about the fact that these medications were approved by the federal government, so they play a certain role in this.
Right.
The distribution of billions of pills was supposed to be monitored by the Drug Enforcement Administration, so they play a role. The manufacturers made the pills. They pushed the pills. The distributors took orders from the pharmacies. They should have known that there were grotesquely outsized orders. And the pharmacists looked in the eyes of the patients who were frequent flyers, never mind the doctors themselves who were writing the scripts.
Prescribing them.
Yeah. So we talk about responsibility, and I don't think any of those actors, as I said, in the tragedy should evade responsibility, but apportioning responsibility when there are so many different participants is a really difficult task. And that's partly why the litigation has been going on for so long, because everybody is pointing fingers at everyone else.
Yes. Well, I want to go to the phones now and talk to Steve in Oshkosh, who has had a personal experience with the issue. Good morning, Steve.
Hi. I broke my leg January of last year. Bad break, had to have surgery and stay overnight in the hospital. and the doctor prescribed oxycodone, which I refused to accept and begged the doctor to prescribe an alternative. He wouldn't give me any alternative. It was oxycodone or anything. I ended up going home with nothing but aspirin. I think it was aspirin or maybe it was Tylenol. And I couldn't even get an ice bag. And so, you know, there was no alternative to oxycodone.
You know, it's interesting about that. I actually had a similar experience. I mean, I've been writing about these stories for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And I've had surgeries and the surgeon insisted on sending me home with opioids and I refused. And I was so angry. I mean, they sent me home for a minor procedure with 40 pills. I was so angry. I wrote to the head of the anesthesiology department and the head of surgery and said, you know, you're a lawsuit waiting to happen. How dare you do this? And I completely appreciate your rage and frustration. I will tell you one thing that's I think is very interesting about Americans versus Europeans. Europeans have a much lower problem with opioids than Americans do. And one reason people put forth for that is that they have different expectations of pain than Americans do. Mm. They expect for surgery to be painful. And they are told that they will at some point get over it. Now, of course, we're talking pain is a huge umbrella term. You know, there's chronic pain and then there's acute pain. But Europeans in general are told that pain is to be expected with surgery. Americans are told they shouldn't have any pain. And so somewhere in the middle, there has to be some sort of mediated moment where you say, you know, it's going to hurt. We can make it hurt a little less, but we don't want to guarantee that you'll have no pain.
We could.
But these are all issues that not only doctors need to think about, but frankly, something I looked in as well is that addiction medicine is not really taught in mainstream medical schools. And that's an area that really young doctors need to be educated about.
Yes.
And I'm so sorry, Steve, that you had to go through that because you knew better than your doctor.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, for your call and sharing your experience. And I feel like it is so common. I know that there have been experiences in my family similar to the ones you described, Jan. And I wonder, did anything ever come? Did you get a response back from the hospital or anyone about the practice?
I got an apology, and then I had to have another meniscus tear repaired in the other knee a few years later. And believe me, I got the same pitch. I think what I find so enraging is that the due diligence here is being performed by patients rather than doctors. Yeah. The fact that Steve, that I have to tell doctors, no, you should not give me this medicine. I mean, that seems to me totally upside down.
And to be clear, none of that will change necessarily as a result of these settlements, of these agreements. Is that right?
Well, you know, one can only hope. You know, me, it's as I said, it's my job to pour cold water on hope, but I do hope. I do hope that there will be better education in medical schools, that hospitals will be more rigorous, that frankly, I have heard in the works, there is a new legal theory being tested, which puts the burden on emergency rooms to show that they have offered interventions when they see someone overdosing to begin to treat their addiction, and that if they don't, they can be sued. Mm-hmm. So if something like that goes forward, I think it would begin to force medical systems to be much more astute about how they handle addiction, propensities toward addiction, and related problems. But I, you know, in closing, you know, I know we have to jump off in a second. I want to give a shout out because I think a huge swath of people who were not really accorded, frankly, compassion in all these settlements are the families and the victims themselves. We've talked about government suing.
Yes.
About entity suing, but 500,000 people have died in some sort of relation to overdoses, to prescription and illegal opioids in the last 20 years. And the voices of those families have largely been shut out of the litigation.
Well, Jan, we will have to have you back to dive into that question and more. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for asking the good questions. They need to be pressed always. So thank you and stay safe.
Thanks. Jan Hoffman writes about behavioral health and health law for the New York Times. Up next is news. Then we're talking about helping your students back into the classroom. I'm Molly Stentz, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz in for Kate Archer Kent. With school starting up, I want to know the word that first comes to your mind when you think about sending your kids back to the classroom. Is it relief? Excitement? Trepidation? Anxiety? Are you worried that your kids are behind academically after last year? Are you wondering about how to keep them healthy until the pandemic ends? How are your kids adjusting? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We have two experts to help us talk through it. Travis Wright is an associate professor of early childhood education at UW-Madison School of Education. Welcome, Travis.
Morning.
And Erica Bullock is an assistant professor of mathematics education and curriculum studies, also at UW-Madison. Good morning to you, Erica.
Good morning, Molly. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you both can join us as we're kicking off this new school year. I know it's on the minds of so many right now. Are we starting off this year behind? I mean, Travis, can I start with you? For parents who may be wondering if last year's educational experience was maybe just a wash, how are you talking to parents about that, about starting off the year?
You know, I think when we feel like we're starting from behind, where we're already making an uphill battle for ourselves. Children are where they are. And as educators, as parents, as family members, we just have to meet them where they are and do whatever we can to help them continue to move forward. You know, children may have lost content last year, and the research shows that, especially for kids from, you know, families with that experienced other types of struggles last year, children may not have received as much direct content. Instruction, but children were also at the same time developing a lot of coping skills. They were developing resilience in other ways. And so I think this year we have to meet children where they are and make the best of the path in front of us. So celebrating what they're bringing, being really mindful and aware of what they're sort of struggling to sort of wrap their minds around, and doing everything we can to help them be successful.
That's such a positive way to think about it. Erica, how do you see it?
I fully agree with Travis. I think that I have watched parents, families, and educators work so hard over the last year to try to create something as great as possible out of a really impossible situation. So I think to describe it as just a loss is really something that discounts a lot of that work. No one wanted to be in a virtual learning environment for the majority of the last year. But what we have to look at is, what were we able to accomplish? And also, what learning happened outside of the virtual walls of the classroom? A lot of the kids learned a lot of things about themselves, about the world, and about their academic things that are related to their academic subjects over this last year and a half. And we want to make sure that we make space to acknowledge that and bring that learning into the classroom as well.
Is that something that's currently the subject of study right now? Is this something that we might glean some knowledge from in the years to come? What exactly the impact of this past year was, Erica?
Oh, definitely. There, I know several studies I have one myself that is beginning, where people are trying to look at exactly what the effects of the last year have been, both positive, if you will, and negative. So I do think, unfortunately, research runs a lot slower than we'd often like. So I think in the coming years, we are going to learn a lot about virtual learning and its opportunities and maybe some of its disadvantages, and just about the type of learning that happens in homes and families as well across different cultural backgrounds and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And Travis, are you seeing a lot of families that are really adjusting to being back into a classroom, being back into a social setting after the year we've had with so many districts being virtual and so much instruction being in front of a screen?
Yep, absolutely. You know, I think what's important to keep in mind is that there wasn't just one COVID experience of the last year. Children and families had lots of different types of experiences. Some children actually struggle with the typical school environment because of, you know, peer pressure or different expectations or whatever. And so there are actually some children that thrived with the benefit of sort of more individualized instruction. And so those children are experiencing a lot of anxiety about returning to the classroom because of the typicality of it all. Of course, many families are worried about children's safety and how they're going to cope with the sort of ongoing pandemic with the return to classroom. So many families are having separation anxiety, children and parents, because they've spent a lot of time feeling more connected. And certainly there are external stressors that are just making it scary for them to be apart. And I think a lot of teachers and kids are sort of adjusting to the new routines. You know, for young children, particularly a year away from routines, rituals, structures, there's just some reentry there that kids have to learn. And so I would say that parents and teachers need to be really patient with children sort of readjusting to the demands of the classroom. And also, just because kids may have been able to be sort of successful in that environment in the past, it doesn't mean that they necessarily kind of remember the rules of the game. And so I would encourage families and teachers to really spend some time over the next month sort of revisiting routines, being very explicit in explaining to children sort of what the expectations are, how things might be done, you know, getting kids into a bedtime, getting kids into a morning and nighttime ritual, talking with them about ways that they might sort of be successful during the day. Those are all some things that we can do to help kids be more attuned to the expectations of the sort of in-person learning environment, and to help them feel a little more in control of their daily lives as well as they're navigating anxiety.
Right. And I imagine there's some positive routines, you know, some of the like picking out of back to school clothes and getting your backpack ready and your lunchbox, like all of the kind of familiar comforts that maybe weren't present last year with the change of routines. There's some excitement there.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been sort of in the midst of that in my house. I have 8-year-old twin daughters who are starting third grade, and they are just thrilled to sort of, you know, pack a lunch, have their backpacks. We got to do some school shopping. And so I think sort of that sense that things are returning a little more to what they thought school would feel like is actually helping them feel excited. And so I would encourage, you know, families to capitalize on that, sort of help kids create some positive expectations as well. So, you know, one of the things that we have been doing with our own kids is sort of asking them sort of, you know, what are you worried about, but also what are you excited about this year? We're sort of talking about sort of, you know, what's one thing that you want to do for yourself this year? So what's a new thing you want to learn? What's something that you want to make out of this year? And that's it's sort of the intention behind that is to help the children start to realize that they can have some control over their experiences, even if there are lots of things that are outside of their control. And I think especially at a time when things do feel so large, so much larger than, you know, the parents and the family and the children, having some things that help us feel anchored, that help us feel safe, and that help us feel like we can choose and have some control over is really important for helping all of us to stay grounded in these uncertain times.
Yes. We're speaking with Travis Wright, an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Education, also Erica Bullock, assistant professor, also at UW-Madison. And I want to invite in a caller. I want to talk to Laura from Manitowoc. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. I guess my purpose for calling is just to represent, I think, an uncommon side of virtual learning during a pandemic, and to touch on something one of your guests touched on also, and that is, I mean, that there were some positive results of the virtual learning. Just to give you our anecdotal experience, my son was entering an important year of school, his eighth grade, and when the pandemic hit, we had a choice to have him be in the classroom or to learn virtually, and we chose for him to learn virtually. And we kind of did some hard thinking at the start of it and confronted it like so many other things in life, and did a lot of talking and introspection about, you know, how this was a big change, how there were a lot of unknowns, and focused a lot on resilience and kind of rolling with the punches. And I think he really, really just blew us all away with how he stepped up to the plate. And not to pat us on the back or anything, but I think to go into it with that intention that this is going to be a challenge, I think he really learned some lessons about adaptation there. And he yes. actually ended up having a great year and really learning a lot about self-sufficiency and lots of other skills that'll help them going into, you know, high school and beyond.
Oh, Laura, so good to hear. Thank you so much for your call this morning. And so glad you had a good experience. Erica, is that a common experience that you have heard from parents, that attitude and kind of how you approach the situation, how you go into it with a positive intent and reinforce the challenges and the possibilities of the year, that really can affect your students' outcomes?
Oh, absolutely. I think what Laura highlights on several levels is really important for us to think about. I agree with Travis and with Laura that there were a lot of success stories in the virtual learning environment that we do need to pay attention to. I hear that a lot from families of children of color, that there were a lot of pressures that they did not have to deal with that they would deal with in the classroom that made the learning environment a little bit more comfortable. And we have to acknowledge that. And think about what that means for us going forward. In terms of attitude, we talk about this a lot in mathematics. We hear a lot of conversation about math anxiety and how discouraging parents from saying things like, oh, well, I was never a math person, I never got this, and how that really can erode the child's sense of self-esteem and self-efficacy as it relates to mathematics. And so that attitude has been borne out in study after study to actually have an effect on the learning. And I would add to that our silence about mathematics does the same. So if in our homes, we're only looking at reading, we're only reading with our kids and not engaging in mathematics, that silence can also kind of inadvertently undermine that child's confidence in learning mathematics specifically.
Erica, I want to talk more with you about that. We are going to take a quick break. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the start of the new school year and the return to the classroom. But the coronavirus pandemic is not yet over, and there's still no vaccine for kids under 12. And are we making up for lost time after our pandemic year? We've got two education professors here to help us wade through all of it, answer your questions. We're talking to Travis Wright and Erica Bullock from UW-Madison. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org. Well, Erica, we were just talking about math and the importance of parents and caregivers and educators helping set a positive intent for their children's success. And I wonder what you saw over the past year with the virtual experience. Was mathematics, was that a subject that lent itself better to virtual learning? Was that perhaps something that was able to be done more effectively in a virtual environment? What did you see over the past year?
I think it's hard to say kind of in a blanket way. I think there were a lot of opportunities that teachers found to teach math in very different ways that were incredibly effective. So I do think that I can say for sure that math was not kind of left out or set aside in the virtual learning transition. There was definitely a lot of great opportunity and a lot of great teaching and learning happening for sure. I think there was a lot more discussion around the mathematics than you might see sometimes in the classroom, because you were kind of forced to actually talk through what students were doing and what teachers were doing. So there was a lot more conversation, which is something that most mathematics educators have been advocating for a long time. So I think that the virtual learning environment created an opportunity for discussion, for collaboration among students, for individualized attention, as Travis was mentioning earlier, that those opportunities sometimes get a little bit lost in the regular classroom environment.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you have to parents who feel like their children may be struggling or may be behind or just not enjoying the love of mathematics? What advice would you have?
Well, I think there are several things. Number one, we've been talking about kind of putting a positive light on this conversation about learning loss and things like that. But I want to make sure that we also avoid what might become toxic positivity. Mm-hmm. We don't want to talk to our children about, you know, our failings in mathematics or our dislike of mathematics and kind of put a period on those things. It is important for us to be realistic with our children about struggles that we did have and how we got through them or what we wish we would have done. So it's really important to be realistic with our children, especially older children, about those struggles. So I don't want to say don't talk to your children about struggles at all, but make sure you talk with them in a really productive way so that it does not kind of participate in some shutdown. I think another thing that I would recommend is math is often a place where parents will seek supplementary education services for their children. What I mean by that is things like external tutoring that teachers provide or schools provide, services within the community, church tutoring programs, even YouTube videos we would consider supplemental education. I think it's really important that parents kind of look at that approach to supporting their child's education with a really team-based strategy in mind. And what I mean is that parents should work with the teachers to help to understand what really is going on. Where are the challenges really lying with their child's performance? So if a child comes home with a D on an algebra test about solving equations, the problem might not be solving equations. The problem might be that they actually need some support related to integer operations or understanding fractions and things like that. So sometimes that D is actually a symptom of a more an underlying problem that needs a little bit more remediation. So it's important that parents and teachers work together on that. And then as you seek supplemental services, you can be really strategic about what you're looking for and what skills you're looking to support your child with. And I think at that point, those services become a lot more effective.
Sure. And I don't want to overlook the pandemic that is still ongoing and still in the background, as we know that more children are contracting the coronavirus. We know the Delta variant is more transmissible. We know that there's a lot of discussion right now in schools around safety measures. And Travis, I wonder what advice you have for parents for setting expectations or tones with your children about safety at school.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think that we have to really sort of separate sort of the child level from the society level. And we, as parents and as advocates, sort of need to be working at both. At the child level, I think the more that we can do to help children feel more power and control and safe in their own lives, the better they'll do. So talking with children about masking as a way to keep themselves safe, talking about washing their hands, talking about social distancing, giving them specific strategies that they can use to take care of their bodies and to keep themselves safe will help children feel like they have more power and agency in what is a really scary time for lots of us. I think at the societal level, we need to be talking more about sort of mask mandating. There's pretty robust research that has emerged over the last several months that suggests that when all teachers and children in buildings use masks, that schools are actually quite safe. And so my concern is that we've politicized a public health issue that is actually creating sort of less safety than children might be experiencing in teachers. And so I think that we need to be, you know, at the social level, talking about really acting in children and families' best interest in sort of following the science. And I think that also sort of maps on to some of the, you know, I really loved Erica's use of the term toxic positivity. I think in today's conversation, we're focusing a lot on the individual. And I think absolutely in challenging times, children have a chance to see how strong they are. And I think having really explicit conversations with children and families about what they've learned, how they've benefited, how they've grown, what they might even redo based on sort of what they've experienced this year. Those are all really good ways to consolidate the learning of this challenging time. But I do think we would be remiss if we didn't say that COVID has also just exacerbated and revealed sort of the structural inequity. So all children didn't have equal access to learning opportunities or the same types of learning experiences during the previous year. And so I think being responsive to that and making sure that as children return to schools, that schools are able to make sure that, you know, kids get the remediation and support that they need to be successful is also incumbent upon us to make sure that all kids can feel safe and learn and grow and look into the future and feel excited.
Yes. Well, best of luck to you both for the school year ahead for you both. And thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Molly.
Yes. Thank you, Molly.
We've been speaking with Travis Wright, an associate professor in counseling psychology at UW-Madison School of Education. Erica Bullock is assistant professor of mathematics education and curriculum studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Molly Stenz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.